Hey, you're listening to the Smoked Meat Podcast. I'm your host, Brad Pittman. Smoked Meat's brought to you by Joe's Underground at the corner of 8th and Broad in Augusta, Georgia, in the bottom of the Lamar Building. Such a great place to go. You always meet new friends. You get to hang out with your old ones. I love going there. They make me feel like family every time I go. Go see Jeremy and the gang at Joe's Underground, the corner of 8th and Broad in Augusta, Georgia, in the bottom of the Lamar Building. Remember, I goes to Joe's and so should you. I've also got a new sponsor here on Smoked Meat I'm really excited about, the Four Points Trading Company. I've never been a real big candle guy. My wife took me to get some, you know, we went out just looking around one Saturday, and I found these candles. I found one that said Firewoods. I'm like, I'm going to see what this is. And I smelled it. I'm like, I got to get this. And then I saw one that said Whiskey, and they had my heart. And I came home, and I brought them down to the studio and lit both of them up. And, oh, man, it's so wonderful down here now. It was good enough where I got in touch with them. I said, look, man, I want to work with you. And they have been so great. They've got all kind of different smells. They got man candles, and they got women candles. Right now, all my people can use the code SMOKEDMEAT and get 10% off your order. So go to 4pointstradingco.com and get your candles. Today, my guest is Mr. Jerry Laffey. Jerry is, I just don't even know what all to say about Jerry. He's just amazing. You know, he was in the band Girl, who has been an inspiration for so many different bands. Then he started, you know, being a personal manager for a film director, and they started doing music videos, and they did some of the videos that are my youth. You know, I mean, I just, when I was talking to him, I was seeing all these videos in my head. You know, I remember Hungry Like a Wolf, Wild Boys, you know, Elton John, I guess that's why they call it the blues, you know, and just so many others, True by Spandau Ballet. And it was just such a treat to talk to Jerry, and he's such a great artist. He was so kind. I asked him for a headshot to put on my wall here in the studio, and he sent me three pictures that he did, and he signed all three of them, and they're so great. All three of them are sitting in front of me right now. So I could go on talking about him all day, or you could go on and listen to me talking to him. So we're going to go on and kick that beast off here on Smoked Meat. Hey, so how you doing this morning, Jerry?
Hey, Brad, how are you? Nice to catch up with you. Man. So how's sunny Atlanta today? It's nice and cool here in London.
It is sunny and not really cool right now, but I walked outside for a minute and no meat fell off the bone, so that was a good thing.
It was 32 degrees in London yesterday, which is unusual for us.
Oh, man. Oh, and that's Celsius, right?
Yeah, well, 32 Celsius. I have no idea what that is in Fahrenheit. We don't work in Fahrenheit much over here.
Yeah, I don't either. But, yeah, that's usually about 90, 95 degrees Fahrenheit over here. So,
yeah, that's a bit hot for me.
I'm a fat boy. I'm ready for cool weather to come back.
Oh, yeah, me too. Man. I don't like hot weather.
No, not a bit. Not a bit, man. But yeah, I've been sitting here talking to you, you know, doing the pre-show and everything, and man, I don't even know where to start. You have just,
well,
man.
I mean, I think what we were talking about was the movies initially, and as I said to you, worked in education to special needs kids for the last 17 years. But I have done movies, and I've done music videos, and I've done music, and I've done art throughout my career. What we were talking about, apart from the Real McCoy, which was the Kim Basinger, Val Kilmer movie that we did in Atlanta, which is why I was saying that I like Atlanta so much, plus I've played a couple of gigs down there, was we were talking about using the Duran Duran videos, the Hungry Like the Wolf and the Save a Prayer videos to blag Russell's first film. Now, as we were talking about, I managed a guy called Russell Mulcahy for 15 years. And we took these little 16 mil $15,000 to $20,000 budget Duran Duran videos down to Australia, and we found a script called Razorback, which is about a giant killer boar, like, you know, the boar that you were talking about you have out in Atlanta, these big razorbacks. Mm-hmm. This one was supposed to be oversized, supersized. It tore houses apart and was killing on the rampage, killing people. Cut a long story short, we used these music videos to blag the film and thought, oh God, how are we going to do this? We've got all these music videos to do in England. We better run back and knock out these music videos and come back and do the prep for the film. All the time, the movie thinking that we were spending months and months doing storyboards and prepping for the film. So anyway, we flew back to London. We did I'm Still Standing. That's why they called it the Blues for Elton John. We did Total Eclipse of the Heart for Bonnie Tyler. We did Something I Should Know for Duran Duran. And we did Hungry Like the Wolf. Iceland, Ice House. And we did True for Spandau Ballet. The week that we left to do the movie, I think True and Something I Should Know were really at the top of the charts. And I think it was Spandau Ballet's first number one. Mm-hmm. And the week that we finished the movie, Total Eclipse of the Heart was number one both sides of the Atlantic. So no one really knew we'd been away. And in the meantime, we'd made this little movie, which was very visual, about a giant killer pig, which launched Russell's career, and within short measure, he got a call to do the Highlander film, which was with Sean Connery and Christopher Lambert and Queen doing the music. So for me, it was an amazing mash of, you know, being in a movie business, quote, movie business, and like hanging out with the likes of Freddie Mercury and Brian May. It was kind of cool. I was young and impressionable. I was in my mid-20s, and it was a heady time for me.
Oh, man. Yeah, I just love the fact that, you know, y'all got the movie, and, you know, of course you came back and, you know, knocked out these videos. Just as you say, we just knocked them out real quick. And, you know, every video you named is, man, I'm sitting here in the '80s right now, because those were my,
you know,
my
Russell,
teen years.
Russell,
man,
he was really a phenomenal director, and the speed that he worked at was amazing. Most of those videos he's done, with the exception of like Wild Boys, which was a huge production, nearly all of those videos were like one day production. They were 2 or 3 days of prep, one day shoot, and like a day in the edit suite. And he really knocked out good quality work, and they were a lot of award. They called him the 3 minute Spielberg with good reason often. Mm-hmm. Because with minimal budgets, he made people look absolutely incredible. And people like Kim Carnes acknowledged Russell that, you know, without that video, Betty Davis Eyes would not have been a number one, and I wouldn't have sold 10 million copies of that. And, you know, he really did have people lining up. Initially, he got lucky, I got to be honest with you. He had people like Spandau Ballet and Duran Duran were new kids. And when those became huge hits, the Elton Johns and the Rolling Stones and the Fleetwood Macs and the Rod Stewarts came out of the woodwork and said, hey, I want some of that too. So, you know, all of a sudden, from knocking out little videos, he was really, you know, quite a big shout. MTV was a big sensation in the 80s, as you remember. So yeah, it was all of a sudden, it's like, what, we're on in 50 countries at once all day long? I mean, bands were lining up to get music videos made.
Yeah, and, you know, that's one thing that kind of makes me sad is a lot of groups, the music video is gone, pretty much.
It seems to, yeah.
I
mean, a lot of stuff now. No, I think it's a shame too. A lot of stuff seems to be made virtually on people's phones these days. There's no record companies are so, they're just not the creatures they were 30, 40 years ago. You know, people now, they make music in their bedrooms and they upload it, and people, you know, buy it or they get it from Spotify or YouTube or wherever they get it. And the music industry is gone. The days of spending $500,000 to make a music video is just long gone.
Yeah.
But I think Russell realized that, and he realized that he had to get out of music videos. We thought it was going to disappear much quicker than it did, actually. And he wanted to use that 35 mil format to get into making movies. And as I said, he's made 10, 15 movies, and recently has been producing TV shows like Teen Wolf. He's executive producer and director on a lot of those. And mm-hmm. Television will run. I think television was going to take a lot to get rid of, but certainly the music business is on its feet. And the last 5 years or so, people haven't made money from selling records. They've made money from selling tickets. Friends of mine, like the Def Leppard guys and Duran Duran and LA Guns and all of that, they've made money from bums on seats. Well, as you can imagine, they've made nothing this year.
Yeah.
The Def Leppard guys had a huge tour booked in America this year with Motley Crue and I can't remember the other bands.
Yeah, it was Poison, I think it was Metallica. I can't remember, but yeah, that was going to be here in Atlanta this month.
Yeah, I think actually it was Def Leppard, Motley Crue, and Poison, Joan Jett. I think it was that
that's
lineup. Yeah, it was all stadiums, every single show. It was the first time they've ever done it in America. They've done stadiums in Mexico and in South America and stuff, but this was their first time of all stadiums, like in the States. It was going to be their big wham bam. Yeah. And of course, it got cancelled. It's all been postponed to next year, but who knows whether it's going to happen next year? Would you want to sit next to 90,000 people in an arena? I don't think I would.
No. Which I don't know. Exactly. For that lineup, I'd wear a mask.
Well, that's right. I mean, it might be worth getting a respirator and going and see that show, but I don't know.
I wear one anyway. I might as well see some good groups, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of people, including myself, miss seeing live stuff, but I haven't done live performances myself for a long time, but as you've seen from my resume, I kind of do art and music and special needs and, you know, a lot of this stuff. What I'm doing this promotion tour for at the moment is about at the end of August, Cherry Red Records are releasing all of my catalog, 16 albums all at once. Well, actually, 8 of them are girl box sets. They're on CD releases, 2 girl box sets of The Sheer Greed and The Wasted Youth, and they're already out on Cherry Red. And on August the 28th, they're releasing all of it on stream and download. Plus, I've got a merchandising company because I've been asked many times over the years about girl merchandising and where can I get a shirt and this, that, and the other. So I thought, I'm going to deal with it myself. So if you go on Facebook, there's a group called Sheer Greed, which is the name of the debut girl album. And there's also Noise Merch, is a big trading company in England called Noise Merch, and they do all the rock and roll merch. And both my art and the girl stuff is all the merchandising is on there. And that's all kind of out in August, which is why I'm waving my flag at the moment. Mm. Plus, I'm on vacation from my college job, so that helps.
Definitely. Definitely, man. And I'm looking forward to this coming, you know, because, you know, like I say, girl, not really huge over here in the States, but.
No, we didn't. I don't even. You know what? I'll tell you a story about this, Brad. Is that there's a guy called Don Arden. I don't know if you've ever heard of Don Arden. He's dead and gone now, but he's the father of Sharon Osbourne, Ozzy's wife. Mm-hmm. Now, he was our record company boss and Ozzy's back in the early 80s, and he was a notorious character from the English music business, reputedly hanging people out of balconies by their ankles, that kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. True or not, I don't know. But cut long story short, we had a bit of a falling out with him. We released a debut album called Sheer Greed, which was top 30 in England, number one in Japan and Thailand and Hong Kong. It didn't really go into America, so he promised us a tour. We had toured in England and Europe with UFO, and he said, okay, right, you sign management to me, because we've already got your publishing and recording. I'm going to put you on the bill with Ozzy, so that it would be Girl, UFO, and Ozzy Osbourne touring across America, 40, 50 dates, which would have been huge for us. And what happened was, because we didn't sign management to him, he was so pissed with us that we got pulled from that, and Def Leppard got that tour, and it was the tour that initially broke Def Leppard in America, opening for Ozzy. They did lots of other stuff too, because they had PolyGram and they had Q Prime management. It was a much bigger deal than we had. But our guitar player, Phil Collin, had left and just joined Def Leppard in time for Pyromania. So he was fortunately on the boat just as it exploded. I think Pyromania went from selling nothing for the first 4 or 5 months. They were really worried, to selling 8 or 10 million records in America. And of course, it broke them wide open in the States. But just happenstance, it was their chance, not ours. It's just the way it went.
Yeah. And that's one thing I've learned, you know, being in show business. You know, I've been doing stand-up for almost 30 years now. And, you know, it's just that one little thing that can, you know, give you that break, you know, and you never know what it's going to be.
Timing, absolutely. You could do a stand-up, and I've done shows like this with, you know, with people, and they might be 8 or 10 people. I remember we did one show with John Taylor. I played with John Taylor when he left Duran Duran in 97 to 2000, and we played in this almighty hurricane in Hallandale in Florida. And there was basically about 6 people in the venue. We had to wade from the Holiday Inn over to the venue because there was like 10, 15 inches of water. And we got over there and there was no one in there. And there was someone in there who was a TV producer who put us on a show. I mean, and I'm sure you've probably seen the same thing. You might do a show that's, you know, 15 people, four of them hecklers, and someone at the back is a booking agent for CAA. You know, you just don't know, do you?
Yeah.
And luck is a huge part of it. There's a lot of work goes into it, but luck is a huge part of it. I'm happy with my career, though. I'm happy that, you know, Phil Lewis fronted the LA Guns and had an incredible career. That was born from Girl. That Phil Collin joined Def Leppard. That was born from Girl. And I've released 32 albums and done artwork and worked with Russell Mulcahy and a dozen movies and 100 videos. I mean, I've had a fun time. I don't regret that Girl didn't break, because maybe I'd still be playing those same songs 40 years later. I don't know if I'd be, unless I was a multimillionaire, then maybe I'd put up with playing those songs over and over.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But yeah, you know, and I'm like you, you know, I've never made it huge in comedy, but I've had a good time. I've made some people laugh, and, you know, I think I've made a grand total of $50, but I've always
well,
done it for
I've
fun.
Made a bit more than $50, but I certainly haven't made the money that Phil Collins made. But, you know, as I say, he may have had luck and he may have had Mutt Lange and good songs and what have you, but they've worked their ass off for 40 years. You know, they've not done nothing but touring and touring and albums and touring and touring. It's hard work doing that stuff.
Oh, man, I remember in you know, 8th to 9th grade, I remember having the muscle shirt. Everybody that was ever a Def Leppard fan had it. The Union Jack with the little Def Leppard logo down in the corner.
That's right, and the shorts and all that stuff. Oh, yeah, they sold that flag. They sold that flag like crazy, didn't they?
Oh, they did, man. And it was funny. People would get them that didn't have the little logo, and everybody would make fun of those people because they didn't have the Def Leppard in the corner.
They were cheaping out on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I remember at the time, you know, when it really broke, I was, you know, I was still obviously quite close to Phil, and I was calling him and saying, how's it going? He said, fucking hell, we've done 85,000 copies this week. And the only thing that kept them off the top spot was Thriller. They were number two riding Thriller for months and months and months. And as I said, this album went from, oh my God, we're not going to break even, to, wow, we've just passed the 10 million mark.
Yeah.
And beyond. And as you know, they're one of the five bands in history that have sold consecutive. I think they're called Diamond Awards, when you sell more than 10 million in America and you get a Diamond Award. And they're one of the five or six bands that's done that for two or three consecutive albums. It's an extraordinary career they've had.
Yeah. And, man, yeah, I mean, like I say, listen to them, you know, that was part of my youth. And like I say, these videos, man, I just can't get past them, you know, just Elton John, those, I'm Still Standing, I guess that's why they call it the blues. That's, you know, I actually wrote those two in my show notes before we even started talking, and, you know, Total Eclipse of the
Heart
and
really
True.
I've really been lucky. I mean, as you say, through happenstance and timing, I just happened to be there. You know, as bands like Duran Duran broke and Spandau Ballet, but also got to hang out with Queen. They did the music for Highlander, and we did a couple of music videos for them. With Elton John, Russell did 22 videos for Elton John, and I was there for probably 12 or 14 of them. A couple of them I produced. Like, that's why I call it the blues. I wrote the storyline for that, about the boy who gets drafted and taken away from his girlfriend. I remember Bernie Taupin saying to me, that's one of the closest, because he obviously wrote the lyrics for it, he said, that's one of the closest concepts that anyone's ever come up with for a music video of where I was coming from. It was like late 50s scene and being dragged away and, you know, being conscripted and all that stuff. And, you know, that was kind of cool. I didn't write many scripts, but that was one that obviously hit the nail on the head. And just hanging out, you know, finding yourself at Sunday lunch with Freddie Mercury is an extraordinary thing for a kid who's from a rock band who aspired to be all of that, you know.
Yeah, hell, that'd be extraordinary for anybody.
That's right. And actually, even at the time, we didn't realize that. No one knew it at the time, but Freddie was already ill. It was 85, 86, we were doing that Highlander film, and that's when he got diagnosed. And sadly, he died in 91, and that was about the same time that Steve Clark died from Def Leppard. I think he died in 90 or 91. And I was one of the several people that got a call after, you know, Phil was going to do all of the guitar duties by himself, and he did on the Adrenalized album, as you probably know, but on when they came to touring live, he really wanted me to do it, but I just signed a management contract with Russell for another 5 years, and Vivian Campbell was a friend of Joe Elliott's and was already in LA playing with him. And I said, look, it's really sweet of you to even think of me, but at the end of the day, we're on different paths and I'm going to stick to where I am. I was living in London and, you know, I had just formed a band called Sheer Greed, which was the alumni from Girl, the bass player, my brother's the bass player, and the drummer, Pete Barnacle, and myself. We were already working on an album. And I said, well, you know, I don't really want to come and kind of try out for the Def Leppard gig, but next time you're in London, come and play on this album. And he did. He played four solos on the album and executive produced it. Phil Lewis from LA Guns came back and did a track with us. It was kind of cool. So everything has its own path. And as I was saying to you earlier, I think before we started recording, there was I managed Russell Mulcahy for 15 years. And when he wanted to move to Australia, I'd had a kid in England. I didn't really want to be flying backwards and forwards to Sydney with a kid, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really know what I was going to do after that. I'd been doing it for 15 years and I was thinking, what the hell am I going to do with my life? And then about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from John Taylor who said, I've left Duran Duran. How do you fancy being the Mick Ronson to my Bowie? I'm going out solo. And I was like, shit, yeah, I'll do that. So I'll tell you a funny story about that. John Taylor, you can imagine Duran Duran were huge for years. Yeah. And he said, my solo album, which I played on a couple of tracks, and has really doing well in Germany, and we've got this football stadium and it's sold out, they've asked me to play, and will you come and do this one show, we'll have 2 days of rehearsal and all that stuff. Kind of long story short, we went and we rocked it up, cranked it up, and we got to this football stadium, quote stadium, and it was actually a football field for a college and it was pissing down with rain, and there was, like we were saying earlier, there was about 300 people there, and we were like, well, not quite what we thought it was going to be, but let's just do it anyway. And we just cranked it up, and we did a really good gig. But poor John, his ego must have been crushed. We, as I say, he'd come from the dizzy heights of Duran Duran, and this guy in German, and I'm only paraphrasing German because I don't speak German, but he was like, "Ladies and gentlemen, du stehst alle weit von der England, James Taylor." This guy looked at his face like, ah, fuck. It's raining. It's empty. No one gives a shit we're there. And he's just called me James Taylor.
Oh, that's awesome.
It kind of bonded us a little bit. And then it was only supposed to be this one gig. And then what happened, we were in a sauna or something in the hotel. And he looked at me and Dan, the drummer, and he said, you know what? There's a NAMM show in New York next week. Why don't we go and do it? And so I was like, are you sure? Okay, I don't mind doing it. And so we went over and we did the NAMM show in New York. And then he was like, that went well. I know a club in Santa Monica. We should go and play that too. And before we knew it, I ended up doing 3 years with John. I ended up doing 9 or 10 CDs with him over the span of years. And we did 3 years of touring. And we toured all over America, which is how I got to play. I think it was called Mamakins, the place in Atlanta. But anyway, blinding show in Atlanta. We played in Japan 3 times. We went to Taiwan. We went to the infamous gig in Germany, which we still laugh about now. But I mean, I'd already kind of, when Andy Taylor left Duran Duran in 86, they called me in and said, we're doing an album, which turned out to be Notorious. Do you want to come and play some guitar on some demos? So I knew them anyway on a social basis because we'd done so many music videos by that time. And it was kind of nice to be asked to go in and play a bit in their studio. And that's how I've done a few things, actually. Same thing with Ultravox. I got a call from Ultravox to say, we're doing an album. Do you want to come in and play some rock guitar on a couple of things? You know, and it's just helped expand my career. I can't say I played in Duran Duran, but I certainly played with Duran Duran. And there's a couple of gigs that we did. One gig in New York, which was Simon Le Bon came in and played with us, which was kind of cool. So I kind of been, it felt like being with Duran Duran, like I've never actually been in a gig where it was that electric. So I kind of saw what these guys dealt with, because when it was the John Taylor Terrorist and Band, and then he introduced, so we've got a guest tonight, Simon Le Bon, the place absolutely went nuts. Every camera went off and everyone screamed and yelled, and I thought, oh, okay. So you can imagine this, that was in a club with maybe 500 or 600 people, so I could imagine that with 50,000 people.
Oh, man.
The adrenaline was high. It was like a, whoa, it was like an adrenaline shot to my heart. It was wonderful. So I kind of felt maybe Girl could have been bigger, or maybe I should have reconsidered that, trying to blag the Def Leppard gig. But not for very long. I love what I do, and I like where I'm at now. I like making my own music and being my own boss. Yeah. It might not be kind of top grade stuff, but I write and produce and play all my own stuff. It's kind of nice being your own boss.
Hey, I look at it this way, you know, everything that you do is what shapes what's happening now. You know, I've done some things, you know, everybody says I regret doing this or I'm ashamed of this. I've never done anything I regret. Yeah, exactly. I don't regret anything. I've done some things I should regret probably, but I don't, because it's all put me right here talking to you.
I've done some dumb things, honestly. There's no doubt that we can all say that. And there are a few regrets. Oh, I wish I hadn't have said this, or I wouldn't have made this person feel like that. But other than that, I just think the life's a journey. It's not about the destination, and it's not about the beans that you collect on the way.
Yeah.
It's about being the best you can be and best you want to be at that time. And for me, I'm an artist. I'm a musician. I'm a manager, I'm a teacher, I'm a lot of different things. I'm not just a lead guitar player. I'm not even that good as a lead guitar player. I'm just a guitar player that occasionally hits a moment where I write a good song or I play a good solo, whatever. But it's not my life. It's one of several facets of my life. I kind of like it that way.
Yeah, you know, and that, you're talking about not being a very good lead guitar player. That reminds me of a quote from the Beatles. You know, when they were in the interview and someone asked Ringo, said, "Ringo, are you the best drummer in the world?" And one of them piped up and said, "Ringo's not even the best drummer in the Beatles."
The Beatles. Well, that's right. But I mean, you know, the one thing that I can definitely say is that, you know, in my my contribution to the bands I've been with and the music I've done and stuff has been significant.
Yeah.
I feel quite pleased that I've made a significant, you know, bands, you know, we've had bands like Guns N' Roses and Cinderella, and, you know, Tracy Gunn secured Phil Lewis from Girl because he was so influenced by Girl. It's really cool that, you know, those big air bands of the 80s, a lot of them cite Girl as being really influential, of combining the kind of glam from the 70s with heavy rock and, you know, coming out of London and the androgynous style and the big hair and hairspray and all that stuff. I mean, we did it 5 years before those guys. It's not to say that the New York Dolls didn't do it 5 years before us. They probably did, and we nicked a bit of that, but we created our own thing as well. Mm. And I, as I'm talking to you, I've got my website open here, jerrylaffyart.com, and I'm, on my bio page, there's one picture at the top, which is all my album releases. And even I sometimes do a double take and think, shit, did I really do all of that? Because I think of myself these days as an artist and as a teacher. So it's kind of weird talking to you and doing promo stuff at the moment, because really, you know, I'm promoting a lot of material from my past, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't drag all that stuff around with you. I'm sure you don't every day when you go to the grocery store think about, you know, stand-up shows you did 10 years ago. You just don't. So yeah. It's weird when you look at things like your CV or you update your website and you think, oh, man, I've done a lot. And I have done a lot. I'm really lucky.
Yeah. You know, I'm sitting here looking at the same picture, you know, just that one square on my screen. I mean, just damn.
Well, those albums, yeah. I mean, actually, and I look at the Girl stuff too, and that's all the stuff that's just come out. There's three studio albums: Live in Osaka, Live at the Marquee Club, Live at Hammersmith Odeon, all of these different things. And I put a DVD together about 10 years ago now, because there was a few bits and pieces on YouTube that were really bad quality, and I realized that I had the masters for the proper videos that we did. And also, strangely, the last interview Girl ever did in Hong Kong was a TV interview, and Russell Mulcahy was in the room filming this thing. So it was a nice crossover of my next career with that previous career. And he videoed just the aping around and the, you know, sneaking vodka and oranges behind the cameraman's back and all of that stuff that we did. And it was Phil Collin had left the band, but it was kind of a bittersweet moment for me, because I was going off to do this Razorback movie in Australia. We did the last two things. The last shows we did were in Japan, Thailand, and Hong Kong. And this was the last two shows in Hong Kong. And we're in this big ass hotel suite, and it was all drinking champagne and rock starring it up. And I was kind of really conflicted because I was leaving. My brother was going back to London, and Phil Lewis is as near to my brother as you can get. You know, bandmates are really close, and he was going back to who knows what. And I felt conflicted that I'd kind of feathered my nest a little bit and was leaving the band and going off to work. You know, Russell had said, look, great, we got a movie, you should manage me. And a lot of people at the time were like, why is a video director got a manager? Well, I'll tell you why. You have a look at Russell Mulcahy on Wiki, you'll see why he had a manager, because he's got, you know, I did 10 movies with him, and we did shitloads of those music videos, and we did big commercials. We were doing commercials for British Airways and Doritos and BP and, like, you know, these really big million-dollar commercials. Mm-hmm. And someone's got to balance all of that stuff. And, you know, it's hard to remember, apart from the fact Russell at one point had 5 homes. He had a home in California, 2 in Australia, 1 in Spain. And I don't know, can't even remember now. He had a big house in London and a flat in Hampstead. I mean, there was lots of stuff to organize. So you could see why he had a manager, and it was a smart move, really, because a little video director, you know, it's like some actors in their local theater, they become Brad Pitt one day, you know, if you're lucky and you got the right people working with you, you can really break it big.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you
but anyway, it was good for me. You know, it was great for me. And while I had an arrangement with him that while he was shooting movies, invariably he would have, like, you're so insular. When you're on a movie set, you've got production assistants and you've got first ADs and producers and God knows what else. I'd basically set up the deal and leave him to it. And that's why I worked with people like the London Cowboys, with Glenn Matlock from the Sex Pistols and Jerry Nolan from the New York Dolls. I did projects like that when he was doing movies. I remember, strange actually, I was talking to someone the other day about this, about the anniversary of Live Aid. Mm-hmm. And I did a show with the London Cowboys, with the guys I just mentioned, and Steve and Barry from the Idols. And we were in Japan, and I flew from Tokyo to New York on the day of Live Aid. And I was so in my own little bubble. I didn't even know it was happening or what it was about, but I had, like, punked up hair and a pink coat and white Capizio shoes, looking like a rock star. And I got to New York, and all these people that I knew didn't know who I was were going, well done, man, cool, have a great show and all that stuff. And I think, what the fuck are they all talking about? and I got to the hotel at St. Regis in New York, and I got this phone call saying Diana Ross calling for Russell. And so I took the call and I said, I'm really sorry, he's on set at the moment, can't take the call. And she was crying on the phone. And I was like, what's the matter? She's like, it's all so beautiful. It's the most surreal moment. I'd had this, like, what the hell are they talking about coming through the airport? And then Diana Ross on the phone crying and telling me it was all so beautiful. What a weird life I've had.
Oh, man, but it's a great one. And, you know, you talk about the teaching you're doing now. Man, I think that's just amazing, you know, dealing with you know, special needs people. And that's a calling.
You know,
right
the
there,
funny
man.
Thing is, the funny thing is, it's like your job, you know, it's like some people can do it and some people can't. I bet you don't go home at night thinking, oh, Brad, you're such a hero, you're so cool. You just do a day's work.
Yeah.
And when you're on call and something comes out, all shit gets put to the side and you're dealing with that moment right there, doing your instinctual job is to help this person to, you know, my job actually is far more fun and far more playful than I can imagine your job being. I just have I'm one of those guys that can sit down in a room. If you put me in a birthday party with 8-year-olds, I can be 8 in 2 seconds. I can be the balloon guy. I can be the guy who spills the soda and all the kids, like, you know, I can be that clown, no problem.
Yeah.
And a big part of my job with working with people with learning difficulties, part of it is like discipline. You're a little bit late and you need to work on that. And, you know, come on, let's focus and all of that stuff. But a lot of it is self-deprecating humor. If an old bloke like me with a bald head and glasses can do it, I'm sure you can do it. Let's try again. That kind of stuff. And yeah. I don't find my job hard work. I don't find my job, I'm not this kind of like hero that some people make me out to be. And my mum, for example, she thinks, oh, you're like some angel because you work with these kids with learning difficulties. I said, you have no idea how much fun I have. They actually pay me to do this. Do you know what I mean? Most of the time, I just have a brilliant time, you know, especially You know, not kind of. I work with a lot of people who are borderline. They're usually on the autistic spectrum, and they're borderline what we call mainstream. So they are really cool with their shoes, and they can work an iPhone and all that stuff. But they can't really deal with people, and they can't look you in the eye and that kind of stuff. But the people I work best with are the people who are very low level ability. I really just love people who the smallest thing, you know, like if you teach a child to use a straw,
yeah.
That kind of, oh my God, that eureka moment. And when I work with people who are kind of, and I work in two different sites, and one is like almost mainstream and one is quite a low level. And when I work in the low level site, I'm much, much happier because I just have a brilliant day. Yeah. And I'm always like, oh, I'm in trouble again, because one of the things I do on a Monday morning, let me just talk about this for a second. Mm-hmm. On a Monday morning, a lot of people with learning difficulties, their routine has changed for the weekend. They don't like change. None of us really like change, but people, particularly on the spectrum, don't like change. So they might get transport into college. They have to come into college. They have to sit in a room. We do maths and English, and they're apprehensive, and they're not really happy. One of the things I do every Monday morning, and have done for years, is I put the date and the day incorrectly on the board, on a whiteboard. I put it up, and I put it up as Tuesday, the 3rd of March, 1982. And just don't say anything. And someone always goes, hey, that's not right. It's a Monday. And I go, how do you spell Monday? P. No, it's M. And you immediately got the whole room's focus in engagement of, I'm so stupid. Every week, I can never get this name and date right. And I say to the teacher, I'm really sorry. I'm just really bad with dates. And let me ask Mike. Mike, what? How do you spell Monday? M-O. Yeah, wicked, Mike. That's fantastic. Judy, what's the date today? And she looks on her phone and tells me. And all of a sudden, you've got the focus of the group. And within that 5 or 10 minutes of that kind of exercise, the teacher's ready to start doing their class. And if I'm teaching myself, then I just carry on. And it depends. Sometimes I support and sometimes I teach. I'm a qualified teacher, but I much prefer support, because you don't have all the quantification and the paperwork and the management meetings and all that bullshit, which I really can't stand. I like working with the students. I don't really like working with the alumni.
Yeah, that's me. I like doing the job, not administrating the job.
Yeah, that's what I meant, the administrators. Yeah. Because, as you know, in that job, every time you put someone into an ambulance and take them to a hospital, you've probably got as much time in writing it all up as you do actually what you did, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure, like me, you like that immediacy of, like, okay, she's settled and the breathing apparatus is on and they're in the ambulance and she's much calmer and you'll be okay, love, you know what I mean? It's like, we're going to look after you. And that is the magic of the moment for me. And the same goes for music, really. Much as I'm really enjoying speaking to you and I appreciate your interest, for me, music is like that moment on stage, the touring, the traveling, the interviews, especially like the record company post-gig bullshit and all that stuff. I haven't got a lot of time for that anymore. Being on stage and going, bring, and people go, yeah. That is the magic of the moment, but that's an hour and a half a day. The rest of it is touring and moving and bags in and out and all of that crap, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's something about the magic of the moment, isn't there? And I guess that's why you're still doing paramedic stuff, is because it's the love of your life. You wouldn't be doing, you're not doing it for the money, and I'm not doing my teaching for the money. I do it because I really love it. And I'm lucky, I prop my income in by my art and by selling my catalog and t-shirts and a lodger and all of that kind of stuff. And you know, that makes me happy.
That's outstanding. Yeah. I love, like I say, the actual doing the job is the best part of it, because, you know, that's what we do.
And yeah.
You know, I'm lucky enough where, as the old medic, I get to work with a lot of these young bucks who are just starting, or, you know, and they're just eager to learn anything that I'll teach them. And that feels good. And, you know, in school, of course, you know, you're taught, here's the book way to do this. This is how you have to do things. And they don't teach you about so many situations that you just have to learn on the fly in a, you know, to without.
Well, I would think a big part of your job is very similar to mine, where you calm someone and you reassure someone and you make them feel that it's not as desperate as they thought 10 minutes before you walked in the door.
Yeah.
I mean, I would think there's a lot of parallels between your job and mine, but you're on a much, you know, much more cutting edge of it. You really are life and death. Mine is, you know, being in a college, students come to our college and they agree terms and regulations of the college, and I have backup, and if it gets hairy, which occasionally it does, we have security and all of that kind of stuff, but you're out on your own. And I would think that, you know, there's probably two of you in your team, right? You could go into situations of real hostility and domestic violence and all of those things you must contend with. And that must be really scary. That's a very brave thing to do, to get out of an ambulance and go into something where you know someone's just been shot. I mean, that would frighten the life out of me, my friend, I tell you. Or even worse, I mean, I can't imagine something like a kid that's been run over or impaled on a railing. Or it's just awful. I couldn't deal with that kind of stuff, honestly. I really couldn't. It'd be very hard for me emotionally.
It gets rough sometimes, but, you know, it's just you figure out ways to deal with it. But I've got a story that I think that you would like. I can't give away any kind of details, obviously, but the short part of the story is we worked a wreck, and the lady in the wreck, she was scared, obviously. She was hurt, and we flew her to Atlanta, and we couldn't land the helicopter where we were. We had to go a couple of miles to a place where we could land the helicopter, and I rode in the back with the EMT. And, you know, because there were two ambulances on scene, I rode in with them. And the EMT's a fairly young guy, and he's in paramedic school now. And, you know, the lady I noticed was wearing a Bob Marley T-shirt. And she's crying. Yeah. She's scared. She doesn't know exactly what's going on. She just knows she's hurt, and she doesn't like it. So I looked at her. I said, "Do you like Bob Marley? I like your shirt." She said, "Yeah." And just without thinking about it, I started singing Three Little Birds to her. And, you know, you can't sing that song. I can't sing that song in this accent. Of course, I had to sing the Bob Marley accent, you know. And all the way there. And this kid's face, who was with us, his jaw just dropped. He's like, "This fucker's really singing Three Little Birds to this patient." And she started smiling.
That's really sweet.
And that was so cool.
Really,
and
it's
just me. That's my instinct.
Yeah, I've had similar situations where, obviously I play guitar. We had one student who was really traumatized, and he was a Caribbean fella, and he was getting really aggressive and really violent, and he's what we call a twister. He'd grab your arm and turn it and turn it and turn it.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman, I thought he was going to break her arm, and there was a guitar in the staff room, and I told someone, "Go grab the guitar." And I just started hitting the three. Jink, 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 jink. And I wasn't really playing or singing anything. I was just got his attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that day this girl saved her arm being broken just by distracting this guy. But I think that's a lovely story, giving the woman a bit of comfort and a bit of humor that would have taken her mind off the panic, because I think probably panic is a big part of what you have to deal with.
Yeah. And what's really funny is, you know, people think, okay, they're brave. They're going in while everybody's coming out, or they're not having a fit over this. You know, while even though I look calm and all right on the outside, Mr. Collected, inside I'm just as, oh shit, as everybody else. I mean, the things we see is not normal. But if I go in there.
No, that's right.
And I'm the one that's supposed to be bringing peace to this chaos, and I'm going, oh shit, then nothing's going to happen good. So I have to.
Do you think this is training? Do you think that's part of your personality, or training, or both?
I think it's personality, training, and experience, you know, and it's just, you understand that even though I may have handled this 1,000 times over my career, this may be the first time this has ever happened to this person. You know, this may be the worst thing that's ever been in this person's life. And you just got to kind of understand that, and it kind of works out.
You know, without being too explicit, you were telling me that you had some issues recently, but also in 2013, I was hospitalized twice, and I'll tell you straight, I had my colon removed. It was a pretty rough year, and I was I did two albums. Two of the albums I'm releasing at the end of this month were done that year, because I was, you know, when you're waiting for hospitalization or your post-op and all of that stuff, and I honestly thought that I might never record again. I had a studio at home, and I had guitars, and I had time, and I thought, I'm just going to write. And I had a couple of things that were knocking around. And that year, it's the only time I've ever done it, and probably the only time I will ever do it. I wrote, recorded, and produced two albums in that one year, virtually entirely by myself. I played all the instruments, I did all the vocals and everything. And it was quite interesting. I got into this vibe where I'd get up at 10 o'clock in the morning and I'd go into my studio and I'd put on a beat and I'd change the tempo either up or down. Then I would sit with a guitar and noodle until something came, and then I would commit to it. Then I'd put a bass down, and then I'd do maybe a bit of keyboards and whatever. Then I'd put a guide vocal. By lunchtime, I was writing lyrics. It was a really interesting experience. By tea time, 7 or 8 o'clock, I had most of the song done, and I was doing like backing vocals, and I had a drum machine, and I would sit there with my sticks going do do da do 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 da, like, because I'm not a very good drummer. But
it was
a really interesting. Well, that's right. Some might argue. I had dinner with him one night. I'll tell you about it in a second. But it was a really interesting experience of always having worked with bands, and they do it their way and do it, you know, for better or worse. It was really interesting, and I wrote and produced a song a day, and I did that. I think 11 tracks in a 14-day period, and then I did another 11 tracks in another 2-week period later on in the year. So I did like 22 tracks in a month, basically. And it was an amazing experience. And these albums are called Just a Little Blurred, because everything was just a little blurred. I was on Tramadol and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was called Wreck But Not Crushed, because it was post-op and I'd had it done and I'd had my colon removed and I'd recovered, and it was all of that stuff. But it was a very interesting, they're two of the albums that are being released at the end of the month. And it was, for me, it was interesting because I've been listening through this stuff again recently, having not listened to it for 7 years. And man, those memories come flooding back. I'm sure you've got videos of performances you've done, and it's amazing how it can go zoop, and you can remember exactly where you were, what you were doing, and what was going on in your life around that time. It's pretty interesting.
Definitely. Definitely. Man, Jerry, I got
Let me tell you about the Ringo thing. Without sounding like I'm name dropping, but you see my CV, it's quite hard not to drop these names sometimes. Yeah. I was with Russell Mulcahy. We were at Elton John's house in L.A., or we'd been invited to Elton John's house in L.A., and he said Sylvester and his wife are coming, and Russell went, you know what, no, I don't think so, thanks. He basically had a, I think what they call it, an artistic difference. He basically been fired from Rambo 3, and he and Sly weren't, I don't think he really wanted to sit and have dinner with Sylvester Stallone. So anyway, got a call back from Bob Halley, who was Elton's PA, saying he's told Sylvester he's got a cold and he's cancelled dinner, but Ringo's coming instead. So we got to the house. I thought, fucking hell, this would be a laugh. Dinner with Elton John and Ringo Starr, this should definitely be a laugh. So we got to the house, and we used to get on really, really well with Elton. We did 22 videos with him, and in the days when he was still doing booze and drugs, he was probably more fun than he is now. I don't know. But anyway, everyone got cut off after that point. Anyway, yeah, I think it was about 91, 92 was the end of all of that era. But it was pre that. So anyway, we got to the house and he said, he's really nice and he's been a friend of mine for ages. Don't mention the fucking B word. That was the only thing. So as it happened, Ringo, when he'd left the Beatles, or when the Beatles fell apart, did a movie called The Magic Christian. And Magic Christian was a movie I absolutely loved. It was Peter Sellers and Ringo Starr. Mm-hmm. And I knew this film verbatim. And at some point in this dinner, when he was complaining about the fish and chips, which was, as you can imagine, fish and chips at Elton John's house, it was like salmon and beautifully made this and the best wine and all this stuff. Yeah. He was moaning about, oh, I don't know, there was bones in the fish. I don't know. It was grumpy. And Russell said to him, oh, I did a music video with you in South of France. Do you remember? And he went, I wasn't there. He went, yeah, do you remember we were there? And he was like, I wasn't there. And apparently that was his stock answer in the days when he was drinking. I wasn't there. Okay, fair enough. So I said something that was a line from the film, and he looked at me and recognized what I was talking about. And for about the next half an hour, 3/4 hour, we were trading all these lines from The Magic Christian. It was hilarious. A tenor? I can't change a bleeding tenor. All of that stuff. It's really funny. And it's something Phil Lewis and I from LA Gun, still to this day, we still quote each other backwards and forwards lines from The Magic Christian.
I tell you what's funny.
So, yeah, crazy old life. Crazy old life.
Oh, man. I remember seeing Ringo in Caveman.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he did try after the Beatles. He was wandering around wondering what the hell to do with himself, wasn't he? But
yeah.
I think, I don't know if you've ever seen The Magic Christian, but if you get the chance, have a look at it. It's one of the most quirky films, and it's got every named star you could possibly imagine doing crazy cameos. You have Raquel Welch in a skimpy outfit being the slave mistress, and you've got John Cleese who's selling a Rembrandt. He's an art dealer selling a Rembrandt to Peter Sellers and his adopted son Ringo Starr, and he's like, oh, how much for this thing? It's like £20,000. It's like, which would have been a fortune in the late 60s. And so he goes, okay, I'll buy it. So he buys this picture and he shoves a pair of scissors in it and cuts the nose out of this Rembrandt and keeps it, this like stamp size nose. And this guy, the John Cleese character, is completely aghast how he could do such a thing. And Ringo says to him, going out, and keep your eye out for a good ear. It's just full of brilliant one-liners. And it's like, and at the end of it, do you remember a song called, I think Paul McCartney wrote it. If you want it, here it is, come and get it.
I do.
And that song, I can't remember what the song is now. But the last scene in the film, there's this huge, giant, like oversized swimming pool. Mm-hmm. And they fill it with pee and poo and every horrible thing you can imagine. They fill it right to the top. And it's on London Bridge, where the National Theatre is now. It's on Waterloo Bridge, right by the National Theatre. And so all of these people coming from work in their top hats and tails or whatever they used to wear in those days are wondering what the hell's going on. And then they start throwing truckloads of money into this giant pool. And there's all these people in suits and ties jumping in after the money covered in shit. It's the most outrageous film you ever see. I definitely recommend it. The Magic Christian. Peter Sellers and Ringo Starr.
I will definitely watch that. Well, Jerry, I tell you, man, it has been a blast, and you know you're welcome on here anytime.
Thank you very much, Brad. It's been great fun. It's fun recalling all these stories. No one else wants to sit and hear them, but occasionally I get a chance to do an interview, and I can dig all this stuff up. It's been delightful to be on your show, and I would love to come back another time.
Oh, anytime you want on, man. All you got to do is let me know and just call and say, hey, I want to record. And you saw, all I got to do is plug in and hit the button, and we're there.
Great. Sounds great.
Oh, yeah.